Hello, welcome once again to Leto's Law. I'm Steve Leto. We've got breaking news in the U.S. Supreme Court. We've talked before about civil asset forfeiture on this channel. And civil asset forfeiture is the idea that if you get interacting with the police in some manner, they can just take your stuff, and whether or not you're arrested for a crime. And if you want to get your stuff back, you got to sue them to get it back. And sometimes it's not worth suing them over. And sometimes if you get it back, you get your stuff back, but it costs you a fortune to do it. So it's a weird concept, and it's been litigated quite a bit. And people immediately go, well, that's wrong. To take someone's property from them without due process seems like a violation of our constitutional rights. And it is. But unfortunately, the Supreme Court in the past has ruled that civil asset forfeiture is okay. Well, a case just got in front of them, and they ruled and issued the opinion today on their ruling. And in the ruling that they just came out now, they discuss not whether it's an improper taking under the, you know, Constitution in that manner. They just simply talk about whether or not it's an excessive fine. So this will help some people in the future with their civil asset forfeiture problems, but not everyone. So it's a good ruling in that sense, but it's not as good as we'd like it to be. And of course, the case, like I said, came down just minutes ago, February 20th, 2019, and Justice Ginsburg delivered the opinion of the court. And she points out that Tyson Timms pleaded guilty in Indiana State Court to dealing in a controlled substance and conspiracy to commit theft. The trial court sentenced him to a year of home detention and 5 years probation, and the sentence also required Timms to pay fees and costs totaling of $1,203. At the time of Timms' arrest, the police seized his vehicle, which was a Land Rover SUV that Timms had purchased for about $42,000. Timms paid for that vehicle with money he received from an insurance policy when his father died. He did not buy it with drug proceeds. The state engaged a private law firm to bring a civil action to forfeit Timms' Land Rover to them, charging that the vehicle had been used to transport heroin. After Timms' guilty plea in the criminal case, the trial court held a hearing on the forfeiture demand. And although finding that Timms' vehicle had been used to facilitate violation of a criminal statute, the court denied the requested forfeiture, observing that Timms had recently purchased the vehicle for $42,000, which is more than four times the maximum monetary fine which would be assessable against him for his drug conviction. So that court deemed that the forfeiture of the Land Rover would be grossly disproportionate to the gravity of Timms' offense, thereby unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment's Excessive Fines Clause. And the Eighth Amendment, of course, part of the Bill of Rights, says that you cannot be subjected to excessive fines. The Court of Appeals of Indiana affirmed that determination, but the Indiana Supreme Court, in its infinite wisdom, reversed it. The Indiana Supreme Court did not decide whether the forfeiture would be excessive. Instead, it held that the excessive fines clause does not affect the states. It only affects the federal government. So the Supreme Court granted cert on that. And the question presented was, is the Eighth Amendment's excessive fines clause an incorporated protection applicable to the states under the 14th Amendment's due process clause? And then, of course, they discuss that in length. So here's the thing. When you get in trouble with the police somehow, whether they arrest you or not, or whether they convict you or not, they sometimes take your stuff. That's civil asset forfeiture. And like I said, that's a taking of your stuff without due process. And the courts have already ruled on that. So what we're looking at here simply is, if they take your stuff and you are convicted of a crime, could we say then that them taking your stuff is an excessive fine? And If it's looked that way, well, it could be. Depends on how much they take and what you're charged with. So they go, Justice Ginsburg explains the history of this, and it's fascinating. I love this stuff. When ratified in 1791, the Bill of Rights applied only to the federal government, which is true. But the constitutional amendments adopted in the aftermath of the Civil War, however, fundamentally altered our country's federal system, with only a handful of exceptions. The Supreme Court has held that the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause incorporates the protections contained in the Bill of Rights, rendering them applicable to the states. A Bill of Rights protection is incorporated, they have explained, if it is fundamental to our scheme of ordered liberty or deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition. Okay? So under the Eighth Amendment, excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. So those three things are all prohibited by the Eighth Amendment. And she writes, taken together, these clauses place parallel limitations on the power of those entrusted with the criminal law function of government. Directly at issue here is the phrase, nor excessive fines imposed. which limits the government's power to extract payments, whether in cash or in kind, as punishment for an offense. The excessive fines clause, by the way, traces its venerable lineage back to at least 1215 when the Magna Carta was signed, and that guaranteed that a free man shall not be amerced for a small fault, but after the manner of the fault, and for a great fault after the greatness thereof, saving to him his contentment. Old English looks like English, but it doesn't read the same. As relevant here, Magna Carta required that economic sanctions be proportionate to the wrong and not be so large as to deprive an offender of his livelihood. Commentaries on the laws of England by Blackstone says no man shall have a larger amercement imposed upon him than his circumstances or personal estate will bear. Now, despite that, it turns out that the British English kings, like the Stuart kings in particular, were criticized for using large fines to raise revenue and harass their political enemies, and sometimes they would detain those who were unable to pay. In essence, you'd become a debt prisoner. Across the Atlantic here, this familiar language was adopted almost verbatim, first in the Virginia Declaration of Rights, then in the Eighth Amendment, which states excessive bail should not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Okay, so we've got that. Now, there's more history to this, but as time has gone by, as I'm sure you know, we've already talked about, the Bill of Rights was originally intended just to constrain the government from taking away the rights of people, and it was originally written for the federal government. But after the Civil War and the 14th Amendment's passage, the Bill of Rights has been pushed onto the states as well. So the federal government can't, for instance, take away your right of free speech, and neither can the state governments. So that's a good thing. So the excessive fines clause is in there with these other ones. And so today, acknowledgement of the right's fundamental nature remains widespread. As Indiana itself reports, all 50 states have a constitutional provision prohibiting the imposition of excessive fines either directly or by requiring proportionality. And that's directly from Indiana's own brief on this issue. So, in short, this is again a summation here, the historical and logical case for concluding that the 14th Amendment incorporates the excessive fines clause is overwhelming. Protection against excessive punitive economic sanctions secured by the clause is, to repeat, both fundamental to our scheme of ordered liberty and deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition. Now, here's the thing. Indiana actually made two arguments that they wanted to say supported their position. And the state of Indiana does not meaningfully challenge the case for incorporating the excessive fines clause as a general matter. Instead, the state argued that the clause does not apply to its use of civil in rem forfeitures because the state says the clause's specific application to such forfeitures is neither fundamental nor deeply rooted. They're talking about the idea that they can just take your stuff, okay? I wish they'd just say that. We would like to maintain the right to just take people's stuff. If they phrased it that way, nobody would agree with them. In Austin versus the United States, however, this court held that civil in rem forfeitures fall within the clause's protection when they are at least partially punitive, okay? Partially punitive. So if it's something being done to deter criminal activity or to punish a criminal, then it's going to be looked at as an excessive fine, potentially. In the Indiana Supreme Court, the state argued that forfeiture of Tim's SUV would not be excessive. It never argued, however, that civil in rem forfeitures were categorically beyond the reach of the excessive fines clause. The Indiana Supreme Court, for its part, held that the clause did not apply to the states at all, and it nowhere addressed the clause's application to civil in rem forfeitures. Timms sought our review, referring to the Supreme Court, of the question whether the Eighth Amendment's excessive fines clause is incorporated against the states under the 14th Amendment. That's it. That's all he was arguing about. But in opposing the review, Indiana attempted to reformulate the question, and they chose to ask whether the Eighth Amendment's excessive fines clause restricts states' use of civil asset forfeitures. And the funny thing is that the Supreme Court actually chastised the state of Indiana and said, you can't change the question that's being appealed. Okay, so the Indiana Supreme Court ruled on something, and they ruled in a way that their ruling became final. And the only way to appeal that would be to take it to the U.S. Supreme Court. And so when you apply to the Supreme Court for them to hear your case, you request that they hear your case, you then explain what the issues presented were at the last court that you want reviewed on appeal. And Indiana just, can we change the question? We don't like the question anymore. So they point out that respondents write in their brief in opposition to restate the questions presented is not appropriate. And that is particularly the case where, as here, a respondent's reformulation would lead us to address a question neither pressed nor passed upon below. There's a quarter of review. They can only review things that have been seen previously. They can't review a fresh question. We thus decline the state's invitation to reconsider our unanimous judgment in Austin, the other case, that civil in rem forfeitures are fines for purposes of the Eighth Amendment when they are at least partially punitive. So they basically said, no, you're not, you know, 14th Amendment causes the excessive fines to be incorporated, just like the other Bill of Rights things that we've ruled are applicable. Now, as a fallback, Indiana argues that the excessive fines clause cannot be incorporated if it applies to civil in rem forfeitures. And again, we're talking about the forfeitures where the action is not against a person, but against a thing. That's the fiction, I guess you'd call it. The legal fiction is we file an action against the SUV owned by Tim's, but we're not filing the action against Tim's himself. Therefore, it's an action against a thing, and therefore things have different rights and so on. And so if we're suing this thing, then it's going to have a whole set of different rules than what Mr. Tim's might have, or rights with respect to his what he's entitled to. So as a fallback, Indiana argues that the excessive fines clause shouldn't be incorporated as it applies to civil in rem forfeitures, and we disagree. And here's the funny thing about that. When the Supreme Court says we disagree, they win. So in considering whether the 14th Amendment incorporates a protection contained in the Bill of Rights, we ask whether the right guaranteed, not each and every particular application of that right, is fundamental or deeply rooted. Indiana's suggestion to the contrary is inconsistent with the approach we have taken in cases concerning novel applications of rights already deemed incorporated. And they give some examples. We held that a North Carolina statute prohibiting registered sex offenders from accessing certain commonplace social media websites violated the First Amendment right to free speech. In reaching this conclusion, we noted that the First Amendment's free speech clause was applicable to the states under the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. We did not, however, inquire whether the free speech clause's application specifically to social media websites was fundamental or deeply rooted. Okay? We're talking about the rights, not the specific applications to wacky situations. I mean, don't get me wrong, wacky facts and wacky situations often lead to strange results. But the Supreme Court here is talking big questions, the big issue questions, okay? So similarly here, regardless of whether application of the excessive fines clause to civil in rem forfeitures is itself fundamental or deeply rooted, our conclusion that the clause is incorporated remains unchanged. So for the reasons stated above, the judgment of the Indiana Supreme Court is vacated and the case is remanded for further proceedings not inconsistent with this opinion. So if you want to look at this, the narrowest interpretation possible is that Mr. Timms is going to get his SUV back, okay? So if nothing else, it's going to get sent back to Indiana, who's going to have to hold a hearing where it's going to most likely be determined that fining this man the $40,000, $45,000 for his SUV is excessive when the crime only calls for $10,000. Fine, okay? When the crime only calls for that. So that's the very narrow reading. A slightly broader reading is that if you are involved in a situation where you get convicted and there's an associated civil forfeiture action, civil asset forfeiture action going along there, the amount that they can ask you to forfeit civilly in the associated action has to bear some proportionality to the fine that can be levied against you for the crime of which you're accused, if in fact you're convicted of it. But nowhere did they address the simple concept, and this is what bothers me the most, nowhere did they address the simple concept of what happens if you're driving along one day and you're going through one of those states where they do this, they pull you over and they search your car and they find nothing wrong, but they see that you're traveling with $80,000 in cash. And they go, oh, you have $80,000 in cash on you. You must be up to no good. You therefore forfeit your $80,000 in cash. And there are some states that will still do this. Now, I know there's people out there who say, Steve, but there's a logical problem here. If they're limited on how much they can take from you if you're convicted, why are they allowed to take anything from you if you're not convicted? Well, that's where we get into a weird problem, because the Supreme Court has already ruled that civil asset forfeiture can be legal as long as it is simply a civil asset forfeiture. But if the civil asset forfeiture is being justified by a conviction, then there's going to be a connection. Is there a logical disconnect there? Yeah, there is. And I personally believe that them forcing you to forfeit your civil assets when you're not even accused of a crime, or at least if you're not convicted of a crime, let alone if you're not, you know, tried and found not guilty. The point is they can take it from you and not charge you with anything. And those civil asset forfeitures, you can sue them and possibly get your stuff back after a hearing, but that doesn't make you whole. Who pays for that action? So many states are now passing laws to severely limit civil asset forfeiture. And I've seen some laws, people have sent to me, thank you very much. By the way, I was tipped off to this Supreme Court opinion within minutes of it being issued by somebody who emailed me and said, Steve, check it out. Boom. So thank you for updating and stuff like this. And I've gotten updates from around the country of different states that have passed laws saying you can only force someone to forfeit their civil assets if they're convicted of a crime tied to those assets and so on. And that makes sense. You know, if you're convicted of a crime and, you know, you had stuff that was, you know, clearly fruit of that crime, yeah, that makes sense to me. But when you can actually take it from people with no connection, that's a problem. So there are states around the country that still do that. And unfortunately, someone's got to take one of those cases up to the Supreme Court and see if perhaps the Supreme Court might want to revisit the issue. Because I've talked about that previously. This idea of civil asset forfeiture has been before the Supreme Court before, and they have ruled that it is legal. But interestingly, they've now ruled that here's an instance where it's not. And that's one where it was couched as, in essence, a fine against somebody who committed a crime, and the fine was excessive. But theoretically, following this exact same logic, if Mr. Timms had been caught with $10,000 in cash on him, they could have just taken that cash and said, you know, that's okay. That's proportional. That's the fine. But then again, could they have taken more because it wouldn't be so disproportionate? You never know. So, you know, this is a step in the right direction. I'm very, very happy about this, but we need to take many more steps to get where we need to go. So that's the case. I will try to find a good link to the actual opinion. The majority opinion is 12 pages long. There are some other joining opinions, but the opinion itself was unanimous. Unanimous. So that's a win for Tyson Timms, and that is a win for many of us. But like I said, it's not as big of a win as we would have liked. So as always, questions or comments, shoot them my way. Otherwise, talk to you later. Bye-bye.